Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk joins us at his usual time and spot at Pro Football Talk on Twitter. I'm Connor McKnight. Rich Campbell in for Dan this morning. Plenty of storylines as camps are opening all across the NFL next week. Mike, thanks for taking some time for us today. Great to talk to you as always.
Hey, great to talk to you guys. How's everything?
Wonderful.
Good.
The NFL Players Union pushed back a little bit with a tweet and a statement, or a statement in a tweet, about the NFL, the NFL's anthem policy. I wasn't surprised that it happened. I was frankly a little bit surprised that it took this long for it to happen. What is the next step as those two entities try and meet out some sort of compromise on a policy that was not a compromise to begin with?
Well, the NFLPA actually waited until the deadline for filing a grievance arrived. Under the CBA, they filed on the last possible day. I think they understand the potential PR consequences of being perceived as anti-flag, anti-military, anti-country. So I think they tried to tread lightly. They tried to work with the NFL privately before it got to the point where they filed the grievance, and they hope to continue to work with the NFL moving forward. And that's what should have happened from the get-go. The moment that Colin Kaepernick was spotted sitting during the national anthem in August of 2016, the NFL, which created this mess by poorly drafting the policy that says players must be on the sideline but should stand, they're not required to stand, but they should stand, the NFL should have engaged the union at that point and said, let's fix this. They didn't want to do it because the NFL didn't want to make a concession. So now, after the NFL has unilaterally changed the policy, the NFL apparently has an obligation to work with the NFLPA, and that's what they're going to try to do. And the leverage for the NFLPA is, if we have to take this to a grievance, we're going to end up potentially winning because the NFL had no right to change the policy without talking to the union.
So, Mike, the union obviously took some care at the end of that statement to highlight the fact that these discussions with the league or ownership are ongoing. You think those discussions lead anywhere productive? What do you expect might come out of those?
Well, you know, it all comes down to whether or not the NFL wants to give anything up in order to make this happen. Will the NFL make a concession? And the problem is, if they would have made the concession back in August of 2016, because this is how bargaining works. You sit down at the table and you talk it through. Hey, NFLPA, we'd like to have a policy where all the players agree to stand for the national anthem. And the NFLPA says, okay, what's in it for us? August of 2016, it would have been a lot cheaper for the NFL than it's going to be now. Right now, it's going to be very expensive for the NFL to make this happen because it's become such a big issue. It's such an important topic. And so it means more to the union to give up the right to protest, the right that the NFL gave them to protest. That's what it comes down to. So we'll see how reasonable the NFL is willing to be. We'll see how reasonable or unreasonable either side is willing to be, and then maybe they can work something out. And ideally, that would be the best outcome. A situation where all players choose to stand for the national anthem, and to make that happen, they're going to have some alternative way to bring meaningful attention to the causes important to them. And I don't know that all players would still agree to stand for the national anthem, even if the NFLPA comes up with a blanket agreement that that's what's going to happen.
Do you think the union has leverage, though?
I think the union's got plenty of leverage because if this goes forward with the grievance, then an arbitrator may very well say, sorry, NFL, you can't just change the policy regarding the national anthem without bargaining with the union. So it goes back to the old policy where players can be on the sidelines, can kneel, can sit, can protest during the anthem, and there's nothing the NFL can do about it.
Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk, joining us here on the Bernstein and McKnight Show. You've gone back, Mike, you know, twice now in just a couple of minutes to when this started, what the ownership group and what the NFL should have done. I think that's an interesting way of looking at it because I wonder if they'd have started then to work together with players, whether you'd have, and perhaps the NFL just doesn't care that Michael Bidwell is tweeting out his support of a politician, of a Supreme Court justice, through team letterhead. Maybe they just don't care about the blowback on that. But they might not be getting the same type of it if they'd have sat down in the first place. You think that's a fair assessment of the situation?
Well, that's right, because, look, politics is part of football. And as much as the owners want to say, take the politics out of football, they want to take politics out of football on their own terms. I mean, politics inherently is part of football. The moment you make players props in this effort to wrap the shield and the flag, that's how they got into this mess in the first place. It used to be like it is when you go to a college football game where they play the national anthem and then the players enter the field. They're not out there for the anthem if you go to a major college game. 2009, the NFL changed the policy, and that's when they created the poorly written policy that has this loophole that lets players protest. So the NFL politicized the anthem in 2009, and Michael Bidwell, with an article on the team website, I mean, and let's take a step back. Who the hell cares what the Arizona Cardinals owners has Arizona Cardinals owner has to say about whether or not Brett Kavanaugh should be a U.S. Supreme Court justice?
Like, I agree.
I mean, really, why does he even wade into this morass? Because it's not going to change the outcome. You know, it's not going to be when it's time for the deciding vote in the Senate. It's not going to be, you know, John McCain out there with his hand in the air, and instead of putting his thumb down, he's going to put it up. Hey, Michael Bidwell went to bat for this guy. It's just stupid to complicate these issues, to create the perception of hypocrisy. And I think the only reasonable explanation for it is, Will did it because he can. And it's a reminder to the players and everyone else who's boss. And in the NFL, the owners are the bosses.
So, Mike, even just looking through the website right now, you go down the headlines, LeSean McCoy, Marcel Darius, you know, legal problems all the way down. This is June, this is July in the NFL right now. Sticking with McCoy, what do you make of this situation right now?
Well, look, all we know is what's been alleged and what the basic circumstances are. But you've got a former girlfriend living in a house that LeSean McCoy owns in Georgia. There are some sort of legal proceedings aimed at getting her evicted from the house. There's jewelry that he apparently bought her that's in the house. And somebody shows up and robs the house only of the jewelry that he bought and beats her up in the process. And the allegation from her lawyers, they don't come out and say it, but it's pretty clearly implied between the lines that LeSean McCoy, even though he didn't do it, he orchestrated it. You know, this is the kind of thing that could spiral out of control very quickly for LeSean McCoy if there's an aggressive effort to get his cell phone, to get access to his email accounts. Because, you know, I could envision, if there's any truth to this allegation, there's a chance that this was some sort of a Fargo-style caper that went haywire, that, you know, he wasn't supposed to beat her up. He was just supposed to go get the jewelry, and one thing led to another, and it all went out of control. And if that's the case, I think it's going to be pretty easy to piece this thing together digitally. And I think that's one of the things that has to be going on right now. The NFL is already reportedly talking to the authorities in Georgia, talking to the woman's lawyers. And, there's a hell of a paper trail electronically that we create all the time. And I think that has to be examined first to determine whether or not there's anything to this. And if there's anything to this, I don't see how LeSean McCoy survives it as an NFL player. I mean, the pictures were horrific, and the circumstances and just the idea that something like that, he'd have responsibility for it. I think he'll be done in Buffalo, and he'll be done anywhere else.
It feels like the third act of a Law and Order episode where Chris Maloney finally gets his guy. I wonder, Mike, as camp opens for the Bears next week, there's a ton of local interest in how Mitchell Trubisky develops with his offense, with how Coach Nagy works and develops individual position players. Nationally, though, across the league, where are the Bears in terms of camp interest for you, and what one camp maybe has more interest than anything else heading into next week?
Oh, I'm very intrigued by the Bears because they fall into that fairly small category of teams that we don't know what to make of them. You know, with a lot of teams, it's like, well, they're supposed to be good, they're supposed to be bad. The Bears, I don't know what to make of them. You know, there's that DNA from the Chiefs and Andy Reid and from the Eagles and Doug Peterson and Mitchell Trubisky entering year two and the first opportunity he's had to be the wire-to-wire starter through the offseason program and training camp, and he didn't have to worry about sitting behind Mike Glennon. I think the Bears, if they could come out and steal a few games early and build some momentum, they could be a factor in the NFC. The problem is the NFC is extremely top-heavy, and I guess the one training camp that carries the most intrigue because it's going to all play out on TV is the Cleveland Browns. I mean, for a team that was 1-31 over the last 2 years, the amount of optimism that is hovering around that organization right now, it's stunning. And so many people, like, look, you look at some of the odds out there for the futures bets to win the Super Bowl. The last I saw, the Browns were 75-1 and the Bengals were 125-1. I mean, are you kidding me? They've won one game in 2 years. So I'm curious to see whether there's any real indication that this infusion of talent is going to make a damn bit of difference for the Cleveland Browns in 2018.
That's interesting that you mentioned that type of optimism. That exists here in Chicago. I'm curious, Mike, how do you feel like the Bears are regarded league-wide, you know, from that zoomed-out perspective?
I mean, I think league-wide they're looked at as just a non-factor, cannon fodder, whatever the case may be. NFC North, you've got the Vikings, who everybody's penciling into the Super Bowl, which I think is foolish. I think they may not even make it to the playoffs this year. You have the Packers in play with Aaron Rodgers. If he's back, they're going to be good. You got the Detroit Lions with a new head coach and plenty of optimism that he's going to carry some of that Patriots influence. And the Bears are just kind of there, in part because the Bears have just kind of been there, really, ever since the last playoff appearance in 2010, the loss to the Packers in the NFC Championship game. They haven't been back to the postseason. They've been bad more often than they've been good. So I think the national perception is just like, yeah, you know, they're just there. They'll take their lumps. They'll be in fourth place in the division. And I think it's more fair to have an open mind about it. I don't think that it's cause to have, you know, blind optimism, but that's what the NFL loves. Everybody goes to 0-0, and in every city there's a sense of hope that somehow they can piece it all together, even though we know damn well that, you know, a chunk of the teams are going to be terrible this year.
I think it's so important to hear that, right? That we are in this bubble here, and it's easy to listen to Matt Nagy speak every day through the offseason program and soak up the energy he brings and how smart he is offensively, what he can do with Mitch Trubisky. But let's be real, right? And then that's what you're saying, Michael. You know, let's be real. Four consecutive double-digit loss seasons. You know, show it to me first. Show it to me before they take that step forward.
And the NFL is the ultimate zero-sum game. You can't have a winner without a loser. You can't have a good team without a bad team. They play 256 regular season games. Oh, and by the way, this year, the Bears have the Packers, Vikings, and Lions twice. They have the Patriots. They have all the teams of the NFC West. It's not going to be an easy run. But now this is what you do. It's part of the marketing. It's part of the salesmanship. It's part of the huckstering that every coach is doing, or at least every coach that wants to remain employed is doing to try to get people excited. So, you know, there's a sense of hope, and then it all comes down to September. For the Bears, I think September is critical. I don't have the schedule in front of me. But, you know, they come out of the first four games 3-1, steal a couple of games that maybe they should lose, build some confidence that way, and then, you know, come Thanksgiving, that they could be a team that you're paying attention to as we go down the stretch.
They'll start at Green Bay Sunday night, Monday night at home against the Seahawks, a rebuilding or restructuring team trying to find a new identity there. They go to Arizona and then home against the Bucks. Definitely a much easier opening run than they had a year ago.
3-1 is not impossible out of that, right?
No, it's not. It really isn't.
And I think one thing about the NFL, at the end of the season, even though they only play 16 games, teams are so much different at the end of the season than they are at the beginning of the season. And part of it is the process of winning. It validates everything that they've gone through. It makes players buy in more. Jacksonville last year, players were upset during training camp, the extent to which they were being beaten up by Doug Marrone's kind of old school taskmaster ways. But you know what? Once they start winning, they buy in more. And as they buy in, they get better. And I think as you develop confidence, as you develop buy-in, you get better and better and better. And that's why September is going to be critical, especially for a team with a new coach. And it's good they're getting an early start. They'll get the extra preseason game, and they'll be ready to go come week one. And, you know, win or lose to the Packers, I mean, you expect to lose that one, but the next three games, they're all winnable.
Mike, appreciate it as always. Great talking football with you. We'll check again next week.
All right, see you guys.
Mike Florio of Pro Football Talk. You can follow him on Twitter at Pro Football Talk. You know, it's interesting to me, and we're going to do at noon, Rich. We're going to open up the phone lines, and they're open now, 312-644-6767. And I wonder if this is something that speaks to Bears fans, or whether this is just my own kind of bubble popping philosophy? Because you mentioned that the little bubble of optimism that exists probably in every city. I mean, Mike kind of went through that idea. And I think that's fine. I think that's how sports works once they get to as provincial a level as they can.
I completely agree with you.
I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with it until you get to, unless you were to get to a point where you're just blatantly excusing
can't be blind.
Bad behavior.
Yeah, you can't be blind.
Or, you don't want that. But 3-1, okay, but what expectations, right? What, you look at schedules, you look at wins, losses. To be honest with you, Danny Parkins and I have talked about this a lot. I think we've both kind of come down in the same spot. Wins and losses at this point in their regime, at this point in Matt Nagy's coaching tenure, yes, they're important. I mean, this is a results-based business. If you got it done, you got it done, and sometimes it might not matter how it looks. To me, though, with this team, it is going to matter how it looks for me. I need to be shown, regardless of whether it's a W at the end of the day or not, that Mitchell Trubisky is a top-tier quarterback, that he is worth the second overall pick in the draft. He's worth going up to get the second overall pick, and that the coach and quarterback have been paired together properly. I need to be shown that, and I will excuse end-of-game results to a large degree. I find it shocking how willing I am now on July 12th to excuse those results as long as that relationship and that talent is proven to me.
This is what I call the brand of losing. You know, you can separate the wins and losses.
That makes me feel less good about this.
Yeah. It's your brand of losing. Are you losing competently, you know, because you got outplayed, or are you dysfunctional? Are you not creative in your approach? Are you sloppy with penalties and things like that? Things that get people fired in the NFL. And look, what's interesting about this entire season is the mix of urgency for a fan base that has gone since 2010 without a playoff appearance and the patience required to install a new offense with a young quarterback and an entirely overhauled group of pass catchers. How do you find that balance? The urgency to take the step forward and to actually win, put a winning team on the field, at least a contending team on the field, with the understanding that it just doesn't happen easily very often. The Rams last year probably are an exception. You know, we talked about this yesterday off air about how unrealistic that is, and maybe you're not doing anyone any favors by continuing to bring up that example. And yet, why not make that the standard? Why not make that their goal? Because as Mike says, teams got to win, teams got to lose. And it's a why not us type of thing. If you have the right partnership, you start building towards that. And I'll continue to hammer this. It's something Mike said. The Bears are going to be a lot better, more competent in November than they are in September. And it's going to be even better than that by the end of the season.
You mentioned the offensive weapons that Mitchell Trubisky and Matt Nagy have to work with. I've got a list for you when we come back.
You notice this list, huh? I'm always making lists.
Actually, Rick Camp sent me this list. He picked this out and produced a little bit. He always does.
It's a change, I know.
Yeah, I know. I didn't mean to make it sound like that. But no, it's a good list. It takes a look at the league and the weapons that are available to each and every franchise offensively. I think you're going to be pretty surprised about where the Bears rank on this list. And I want to know if you, 312-644-6767, have the same kind of optimism about the weapons themselves, not necessarily Mitchell Trubisky, but the weapons available to him. We'll get to that next. It's Bernstein and McKnight with Rich Campbell in for Dan. I'm Connor. This is 670 The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
That was Tannehill's white whale for a little while, right? I mean, what was the running number on getting him on the air for producers? Like, wasn't there a pot available if you could get him on?
I think so. I think that happened pretty early on when I was here, but okay. I just remember him always calling in, being real nice to me, and asking if Herb was there. And then I'd hand the phone to Herb, and then I'd hear you, that damn Bernstein, Illini, and it was a great conversation.
He's not wrong.
No, I mean, of course he's not wrong. This is the Bernstein and McKnight Show. Rich Campbell in for Dan Bernstein today and tomorrow. Been lovely having him here, and great talking a little football, because as we approach the All-Star break and an off day here for both squads in baseball, it's a chance to talk a little pigskin. Rick Camp and Jay Zawoski, our producers, are having fun with me because, it's not important why. It's July 12th, and it's a day for me, I guess.
Happy birthday. Don't, please don't.
I mean, that we can play as many times as we want. We should have played it for Dan's. Segment brought to you by Walgreens. Walgreens is here for all your diabetes needs. Stop by today to consult with your pharmacist and get trusted advice and tips about your diabetes medications and testing supplies. I know we got the update coming up at 10:30. So there's a list that I want to get to. I guess we'll have to push it to a little bit later in the show. It's about the rankings of NFL arsenals, those who are the weapons in the offenses. And I think you'll be surprised as to where the Bears have ranked in this particular list. But after the update here with Kevin Zipak, we're going to talk with Mark Adams, who's an NCAA basketball analyst and has some pretty crazy ideas on how to lovingly crazy, like good type of crazy ideas on how to remake the NCAA tournament to the benefit of some mid-majors, which has brought a lot of enjoyment to the conversation a little bit later. Oh, yeah, Mark's 10:40 for Mark. Okay, so we can do this now. There's a text in from the 630, Rich, that kind of details it this way. We've been talking about with Mike Florio about the start for the Bears, the first four games. It's Green Bay,
Seattle,
then Seattle,
Arizona, Tampa.
Arizona is the only team in the NFC. I'm going to say this like you didn't say it during the break.
That's fine.
Arizona is the only team in the NFC with longer playoff odds than the Chicago Bears.
I haven't done a lot of research for these shows. That's the one thing I looked up.
that's what you've got. 6.5 is the number in Vegas on the Bears win total, right? And the text in from the 630 says the problem with your 3-1 theory, and it's not really a theory, it's just an idea that that's been thrown out there.
If they can go 3-1
against some bad teams, then perhaps you've got a different looking landscape when you get there. The problem with the 3-1 theory is that it completely disregards the talent level of the Chicago Bears. They're terrible. Vegas isn't wrong. With the over-under at 6.5, I get the bet that Vegas themselves are making, that the house is kind of making here. However, we've talked about this some too. There is a national perspective that has kind of poked a hole in the Bears' optimism bubble over the last couple of weeks. However, I got a list here about the weapons available to Mitchell Trubisky and Matt Nagy where the Bears place in a spot you might not expect. And we'll do it when we come back from the update studio with Kevin Zipak.
Oh, what a tease. Happy birthday, by the way, Connor.
Thanks.
What's your birthday?
Yeah, I know.
So you're a Cancer then? Is that?
I am. I am a team Cancer.
That makes sense.
Hey, you fired up.
You're deeply intuitive, sentimental, enigmatic.
No, all of those things. Yeah. All of those things.
You and Bill Cosby, because it's his birthday too, actually. So
really? Yeah. I knew Richard Simmons.
I was gonna say, you've gone 33 years and not known you?
No, I didn't know Cosby. Bill Cosby. I didn't know Cosby. I knew it was Richard Simmons and Christy Yamaguchi and Topher Grace.
As well.
Oh, really? Brock Lesnar.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
I watched him get his ass kicked once. That was fun for me.
In person? Like live?
No, I think a friend paid for the UFC fight where he got his ass kicked.
Okay.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
The list is out. The NFL's best and worst offensive arsenals from 32 all the way to 1. Bill Barnwell put this out, and I actually kind of like his offensive mind in particular. And I guess, you know, to a certain degree, it's like a fantasy article a little bit. Like, what offenses
quarterback should you draft?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
Now, the rankings are, in his words, an attempt to consider a team's skill position talent level without including the impact of the quarterback, the offensive line, or the scheme. These rankings do not include contract value, solely considering how they're going to perform in 2018, so it's a win-now kind of philosophy, which I think is more important with this league than any others. And yeah, with Mitchell and this offense, maybe you want to look down the line some, but development starts as soon as they open the doors.
So it's all 2018 projection?
More or less, They're okay. weighted a little bit more toward receivers, probably okay. because that's how the league has kind of been weighted. The very last team ranked in this list is the New York Jets. It makes some sense.
Sure.
We scroll up a little bit more. You've got the Jacksonville Jaguars, a playoff team at 25. They got a lot done on defense and... You know, how you like to look at a departure that has arrived here at the Bears, I think is a fair thing, even though he didn't play a whole lot last season. Green Bay Packers at 23.
Retooling. Yeah.
Scroll up a little bit. You've got a couple of, you know, contenders in the Houston Texans and the Saints and the Chargers at 12, 11, and 10 at number 9.
Stop.
Stop
it.
Are the Chicago Bears.
Go Bears!
Certainly fair to say, this is from the article, certainly fair to say that no team this offseason has had more weapons for its quarterback than the Bears. Many of general manager Ryan Pace's moves are gambles, both in terms of the contracts involved, which aren't being considered here, and the track record of the players in question, which are. I mean, that's a knee for Allen Robinson,
this
right?
Is sandbagging the whole thing.
It really is.
Okay.
There's a lot of qualifying language. The other new faces have the potential to break out, but haven't yet been consistent contributors. Taylor Gabriel, a replacement level wideout who the Bears passed on as a free agent before a breakout half season for the Falcons in 2016.
Trey was playing opposite Julio Jones.
When he was, Trey Burton was Philadelphia's third tight end and scored an unsustainable 5 touchdowns on 23 catches last season. Jeez, if this is 9, I wonder what it's
going
to
be. That's what I mean. The league
praise is going to look like for the rest of them.
Doomed.
Of course, you've got Kevin White and Adam Shaheen, who
are drafted
highly and are supposed to be athletic.
Yeah.
Question marks around him. And then Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen. I wonder, you know, briefly here.
So
Rich,
what does he like about them?
Yeah, I think it's potential, really. I think it's the big bets. What pushes the Bears up these rankings is Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen. And their ability to be versatile in the case of Cohen and reliable in the case of Howard. And it's interesting considering that you started this list with the caveats you did and the question marks that we had 3 months ago, 2 months ago with Jordan Howard deleting Instagram posts or not, or having, I don't know if he has Instagram or whatever.
He does.
Know.
Yeah, he just hid those.
He didn't seem to know.
Posts. Yeah.
And a question about his fit in Matt Nagy's mm-hmm. offense, which I think is a valid question. But I've often thought that in this league, when you have clear, evident talent, you find a way to fit that into the offense.
And so that comes to a very interesting point. That is, when we think about Nagy's offense, we think about the passing game because of Mitch, because of how they want to build around him, because of what Ryan Pace comes from in New Orleans and that passing game there. Although that offense is probably well balanced, maybe more than we think about it. Because of Breeze's stardom, I think Matt Nagy really does want to run the ball. He doesn't talk about it a lot. We're not mm-hmm. asking him about that a lot, but Mitch has said it a few times that if the Bears are running it, say 50% of the time, that would probably be more than I would guess right now. And I think that would be a good thing for them. If their offense really is driven through Jordan Howard, while Mitch gets his feet under him. And if we are staying on the Rams comp,
mm-hmm.
which we have said we shouldn't do.
No, we've sworn off of that.
But, I mean, think about their running game, yeah. right? They had maybe the best offensive player in the NFL last season. So to have that resource for a young quarterback is everything. And if the Bears can figure out how to maximize Jordan Howard in the inside zone scheme, let him haul it 25 times a game.
For sake of paying it off, from 3 to 1 on this list, the Atlanta Falcons at 3, the Giants at 2, and the Kansas City Chiefs at number 1 in the NFL in terms of offensive arsenal.
Were the Bears more overranked this year at number 9 or last year at number 26?
Ooh, last year at number 26.
Last year at 26?
Yeah, last year at number 26. That's yeah. clear
enough. They were 31 or 32. Last year.
In all
maybe
reality.
Maybe the Ravens were with them at the bottom there.
He just really likes Jordan Howard, apparently.
Real
he's been a good player. He's been,
yes.
he's been
no doubt.
Available to them. He doesn't really fumble. He's a tough player. You can count on him. Does he fit with this passing game? Do they want to throw to him?
They'll make a way.
Can you figure it out? Can you line him up in different places? That'll be part of it.
When we come back, we're going to have a conversation with Mark Adams. He has put together an idea that may bust up what he calls the NCAA tournament cartel. It is crazy. It's off the wall, and it just might work. I'm incredibly intrigued about it. The guy's got a unique idea, and we like to talk to folks who have one of those. He's Rich Campbell. In for Dan Bernstein, I'm Connor McKnight. It's Bernstein and McKnight, 670 The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Nova went from mid-major to power team, back to mid-major for a while, and with the arrival of Jay Wright, after a number of years, reached the pinnacle of college basketball. Really kind of an incredible story about a system there, being down and then up and then back and then forward again. This is the Bernstein and McKnight Show here on 670 The Score. I'm Connor. Rich Campbell is in for Dan, and we're headed out to the phone lines here. Because I caught something, it's a big long write-up on Deadspin, and the headline reads, "A college basketball insider is uniting mid-majors to bust the big guy's NCAA tourney cartel." That college basketball insider is Mark Adams, and he joins the show now. You can follow him on Twitter at EnthusiAdams. He is a college basketball analyst for ESPN, and he's joining the show now. Hey, Mark, thanks for taking some time out for us. Appreciate it.
No, I appreciate it, Connor and Rich. I'm glad to be with you, and I got to see your Chicago Bulls Summer League team play last night. So, big game by Antonio Blakeney.
Well, he's going to get a shot up, whether it's a good one or a bad one. I have to ask, Mark, it's a buzz, the Summer League, with talk of Wendell Carter Jr. What did you see out of him?
You know, Wendell Carter Jr. is one of those guys. He's such a big target inside. He's got a really sweet fake one way, and then back to the lefty. He can fade. He's got a great finishing body. I mean, he just takes contact. I think he can be crude at times. He turns over his left shoulder at times. He's kind of unrefined at times. But, man, when you look at the double-double potential, the big body ability, the ability to run the floor and catch the basketball, he's got an upside, no question about it.
This is a guest with utility. Mark, this is fortuitous. We were supposed to have you on today. This is great. If you can, describe... because what you've done here in kind of working with Conference USA and with the Sun Belt Conference is rework a regular season schedule. We'll get to how that's going to work in a second, or how you guys plan on making it work in a second. But in your mind, what is the issue that you're trying to fix here with the NCAA tournament? What's unfair about it?
Well, the biggest issue is all the research that I've done over the years. I coached college basketball for 17 years, a lot of different levels. And during that time, at one point I was at Central Connecticut State University, where I opened up my first season there in 1991 with 9 bye games. And what that means is, for the fans unfamiliar with college basketball, it would be like, for example, if Loyola were to go play Clemson and Clemson would pay them $100,000 to play one time at Clemson and then not return to Loyola. Well, I played 9 of those games, and a lot of it is budget-driven because schools like that need the money, the revenue to take care of their own athletic programs. Over the course of time, then I started studying that dynamic across college basketball, and I found out...
Oop. I think we lost Mark Adams for just a second there. It's like the NCAA has hacked into the phone lines. And
seems like a poor time for that to happen.
One and done. Yeah. And one and done. What did he find out? I got to know. Okay, I think we got Mark Adams back here. Mark,
back now.
Mark, yeah, we got you. We dropped you right at the tease point here. It's almost like we should have gone to break.
Guarantee games. And over that time, you found out?
I found out that over the last 2 seasons, the top 6 spending conferences in the country have played 88.5% of their out-of-conference games either at home or on a neutral site. 64% of those total games are at home. So how do they do it? They buy home games. They'll reach out to a Loyola. They'll reach out to a UIC and pay them $100,000 to come play one time at their place and not return the game. Well, that skews every computer metric. Now, in Major League Baseball, the Yankees have the biggest budget in Major League Baseball, but they can't buy home games to make the Major League Baseball playoffs. The New England Patriots can't do that. My local high school team in Springboro, Ohio, can't buy home games to make the playoffs, but yet it's allowed in college basketball. But I was the one voice out in the wilderness just howling about this over the years. But no one else, no other colleagues, no other coaches, no other administrators, no other presidents, no one, everybody accepted this practice in college basketball. And I started asking, why? Why do we accept it? And then how can we fix it? Well, the first response is take away bye games. Don't allow that to happen. But you have two issues with that. Number one is the teams with money, the programs with money, they want to stay at home and buy home games and continue to have their unfair advantage. And then there's the welfare part of it for programs that need the revenue, and so they want to keep it because they don't want to give up a $100,000 payday. So I start looking at, well, what about the middle teams that really don't want to be bought? What could be the strategy for them? And that's how the ideas were born, out of that research and that discussion around this issue in college basketball.
I don't think any teams are calling Loyola anymore to come into our gym and play us. But so then this has been going on for a while. Red teams like Wichita State, they can't get programs to agree to a home and home. There's nothing in it for these power conference teams to go to Wichita and play a true road game. There's nothing in it for them. You lose that game, it's a blemish on your tournament resume. So then what's the solution here?
Well, the solution was, as I went through this entire process, was to look at scheduling in a different way. And so I looked at an entire strategic plan around out-of-conference scheduling, what they call the MTEs, which is the tournaments that you see, like the Maui Classic, in-conference scheduling, and then the conference tournaments. And I was driving down the freeway one day and just really trying to think outside the box. If I just could have a clean slate for a conference like Conference USA or the Sun Belt, or the Missouri Valley. I've been a big fan of the Missouri Valley my entire life, by the way. And I thought, how could you fix this? How could we create, almost artificially create, quadrant one, quadrant two games, so really good games for these teams, even in their conferences, because they're shunned by the big money conferences. They don't want to play them even on a neutral site. That's what came about when we really decided to give birth to the smart schedule, which was to take a portion, a good sample size of.
I think we dropped Mark.
Add four games on the end.
So say that again. So essentially what we're doing, Mark, is we're going to play Conference USA and the Sun Belt Conference. We're going to play about, 14 games, and then seed the teams from top
That's
to
right.
bottom. And those top teams will play each other for a good run and for inflating their own, essentially, RPI, right?
That's correct. What we've done is we've created great matchups in those last four games, and it's really designed for the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee, for them to recognize that, hey, we are taking your word seriously. We are creating the best matchups possible for our best teams in the conference to create the right types of matchups, compelling matchups in February. It's also great for the fans because now we can say we're going to give you the best possible games. We're going to fill your arenas because these are the best possible games to play toward that championship and ultimately earn a better seed in the NCAA tournament field. And if you can go from being a 14 seed like the Sun Belt has been, like Conference USA has been, where those teams since 1985 have won 15% of their NCAA tournament games, if you can improve their seed just to an 11, in that case, Connor and Rich, they improve their ability to win an NCAA tournament game as per the stats since 1985. 37.5%. That's 2.5 times more, greater value as a 11 seed versus a 14 seed with the chance to win a game in the NCAA tournament, which is worth a lot of money.
Talking with Mark Adams. He's an ESPN College Hoops analyst, and he's got a radical idea to remake some conference schedules that'll help some of the Conference USA Sun Belt teams perhaps get higher seeds in the tournament. An honest question, Mark, and you know, having watched last season and everybody here in town was glued to Loyola games the entire way through because of the upset nature in many of them, though I think they were favored in their first-round game against Miami, if memory serves, is that will it make for better basketball? I don't mean to put down mid-majors because we've seen enough of them come out and win games in the tournament. But if you've got four of them like that playing each other, is there a wear down factor? Is the talent deep enough in some of these mid-major conferences to warrant having the 11 seed, despite the fact that you might have the computer models treat you a little bit more favorably?
It's a great question. And these were the discussions that I had with university presidents, athletic directors, media folks, coaches, fans. When I went through this process at 26 different schools, I visited every one, and that particular question came up multiple times. And my response was really simple. How's the status quo working for you? Hmm. And there would be silence in the room. You know, why not take a chance? Why not do something that's what you called radical, innovative, unique? Because the status quo doesn't work for for deserving programs like Loyola. And it's about time the system did work. You know, in coaching, all I ever wanted was an unfair advantage. You know, that's all I ever wanted, was an unfair advantage. And I see scheduling with the money as an unfair advantage. And I decided to take a stand and to work with conferences to give them a new vision and a new opportunity, because the status quo wasn't working for them. You can sit there and complain about it, or you can create a new path forward. And that's what Conference USA and the Sun Belt decided to do.
So to be clear, basically what you're doing here is, for the final run-in for a conference like Conference USA, you're basically going to the next best thing. You're not going to get Power Five conferences to agree to play you on your home court. So it's just the next best thing. You're going to get the best teams from your league and have them just square off. That way you have more games against top 50 RPI teams, hopefully. So in the run-up to that, how balanced are you able to make the schedule? How will that in-conference seeding work?
Well, we're able to make it very balanced, because you do get a very good sample size of games. There'll be 14 games before we go to the pod system in Conference USA, and 16 games before we go to the pod system in the Sun Belt. And so from that standpoint, you really do get a good view of who your better teams are in your league. The other part of it is that from a seeding standpoint, this is a comprehensive strategy. So we took, coming out of that pod system, so your number one and two teams with their total record from the conference, they will be advanced all the way to the semifinals of their conference tournament. Now, why do you do that? Because you don't want your number one seed to play your number eight team in the quarterfinals. Why? Because in most conferences across the country that are underfunded, you have a huge divide between the top half of the league and the bottom half of the league. For example, the West Coast Conference, the top half of the league, has about an average computer metric of an 80 RPI. The bottom half of their league is 260. That's a canyon of 180 points. So why would you ever want your number one team to play your number eight team? Because if your number eight team happens to win, like Southern Miss beating Middle Tennessee State this past year in the Conference USA tournament, that was a number 31 RPI team versus a number 220 RPI
team.
That's
no good.
It killed Middle Tennessee. So there's method to this madness. I think it's smart. I think it's fun. I think the fans are going to love it. But more importantly, the NCAA Tournament Selection Committee is going to be watching very, very closely, because we've created compelling matchups late in the season to battle the big money conferences. And I think that's really exciting.
So, Mark, as we let you go here, and I think it's fascinating myself.
I'm in on this.
Why we call it. Yeah, I'm down.
Yeah.
Three quickies here before we let you go. When does this plan get enacted? What kind of traction has this plan gotten you with other mid-major conferences like this? And what kind of pushback are you getting from the big guys, from the Power Five? Like, are you having, like, calls and then hang-ups from a bunch of ACC, like, area codes where they're just, like, you know, stalking you in the background? Is this a Roger Stone situation? Like, where are you at?
Well, Conference USA, your first question, Conference USA has enacted this. They are going in with most of this plan this season, although their conference tournament will remain the same. So they will have a regular conference tournament where one does play eight this year. That'll change in the following year. But they're going to the pot system this year. The Sun Belt will enact it the following season, 2019-20. And then as far as, you know, traction with other conferences, the Sun Belt and Conference USA, obviously, they got a little gunslinger in them now, and they're going after it, and I like that. Everybody else is standing back and watching, because everybody wants to dance with the prom queen, you know?
Yeah.
But the prom queen's already got a date, and those conferences are going to have to stand up and take notice that we are driving change throughout this system, and it's time to jump on board. Your last question about the top six budgeted program or the conferences in the country. No, they're not calling me. I don't think they're stalking me, but I think they're watching it very closely, because there are millions of dollars in the balance here. And I believe this will work, by the way. I believe there will be better seeds, and I believe if these conferences catch lightning in a bottle, there can be a second bid that's earned, like the Valley has been doing. And my phone number, I gave it to you, and I give it to every conference in the country. When they're ready to talk, I'm ready to listen and start and continue this revolution across college basketball, because that's what it is. It's a movement. It's a revolution. and I'm excited to be a small part of it.
Mark, we love that kind of talk here on the show. Couldn't be more excited to talk with you, and we will follow up. We'll be talking again once the pod system starts in Conference USA just a little bit from now.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate your time today.
You got it. Mark Adams, college hoops analyst for ESPN.
Full of radical
idea.
I love it.
Man, that's what you got to be. You got to be a gunslinger if you're going to change the system like that. That is, as much money as goes into college football, the tournament is the biggest money driver for the NCAA, and it has been aligned as such for a reason because it's put money in the right places.
Here's the thing about that, too. Over the last, let's say, 15 years, maybe not quite that long, but about the last 15 years, the talent level, you know, the tide throughout the college basketball landscape has risen.
Feels that way.
It has risen. I mean, there are good players everywhere. There are good players at Loyola, and go on down your list of mid-majors, and they get showcased in this tournament. But he's absolutely right that these scheduling formats do hamstring these programs when it comes to these metrics that the committee looks at, and it'll be really interesting.
Segment brought to you by Spot Hero. Finally, here's a way you can save time parking. Use Spot Hero anytime you park. First-time users can enter the promo code SMART for $10 off. Spot Hero, park smarter. He's Rich Campbell in for Dan Bernstein. The midday midway is next. I'm Connor. You've got 670 The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.